Today, WWE television programming is synonymous with Raw and SmackDown, but that was not always the case. In this video, I'm going to give you a complete rundown of WWE, or as it was at the time, WWF television before Monday Night Raw, which launched in January 1993. Now, this is going to be as in-depth as anything you'll find online in video or in written form, especially if it's done by one of the more mainstream wrestling sites or Conrad Thompson or Bleacher Report or whatever. I'm none of those people, so do strap in. I have made two previous shows looking at how the WWF was booked and how it expanded, which I encourage you to watch. One is about the time of Vince McMahon Sr., and the other is about how Vince McMahon Jr., his son, expanded the original territory and the changes he made to transform pro wrestling. These are Deepest Laws 30 and 67, respectively. There's also a bonus show, Deepest Law 69, which looks at specific towns and arenas that Vince expanded into from 1984 onwards. If you watch them, that will give you a lot of the good background for this show, which is just going to be focused on television. Now, to begin, we need to rewind all the way back to Vince Sr. days, when the company was called WWWF, which was a kind of super territory that promoted the northeast portion of the United States, comprising New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Maine, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and then down to Maryland and Washington, D.C. At this time, Vince Sr. had two shows on syndicated television: Championship Wrestling, which was the A show, and All-Star Wrestling, which was the B show. Vince McMahon Jr., his son, then in his 30s, was the commentator, often solo. And at some point, the longtime champion of the company, Bruno Sammartino, joined him as a color analyst, I think, in 1979, 1980 sort of time. Vince also handled all interviewing duties. Championship Wrestling and All-Star were always filmed in the same arenas, and TV tapings would film three shows at a time, which meant they were back in each arena every fourth week. Championship Wrestling TV tapings were on Tuesdays, and All-Stars TV tapings were on Wednesdays. Championship Wrestling was filmed at the Agricultural Hall in Allentown, Pennsylvania. It's distinctive because that was the arena that came with its own ring announcer, Joe McHugh.
Deputy Commissioner Peter Lash, the Doctor in Attendance at ringside, Dr. Larry Bender, the timekeeper at the bell, Mike Mittman, and the referees for this hour of wrestling, Dick Wally, Gilberto Roman, Danny Davis, Dick Crow, and my name is Joe McHugh.
All-Star was taped at the Fieldhouse in Hamburg, Pennsylvania, which is only about a 40-minute drive away from Allentown. So you can imagine, logistically, that was quite compact. It worked quite well for the company. Hamburg tapings would have Gary Michael Capetta as the ring announcer.
It's Dr. John Woods. The referees assigned by the State Athletic Commission are Freddie Sparta, Danny Davis, Dick Worley, and I'm your ring announcer for All-Star Wrestling, Gary Michael Capetta.
At some point, All-Star and Championship Wrestling switched arenas, but for most of the run, Championship Wrestling was in Allentown and All-Star was in Hamburg. When Vince McMahon Jr. talks about taking wrestling out of the smoky halls, it is likely the Agricultural Hall in Allentown that he has in mind. It has a very kind of specific feel, that venue, which you can see here. Now, for those who live outside the USA, and especially British viewers, in America, there are many local TV stations that only air in a local market. These could be affiliated to a bigger network such as Fox or NBC, or they can be independent standalone stations, especially back in the early 80s, which we're talking about now. If the local TV station took only one wrestling show from the WWWF, it would be the A Show, Championship Wrestling. This is where most of the major angles and storylines happened, and where the bigger stars would have time to shine. If a station took both shows, the B Show, that is All Star, would have invariably the less prominent time slot. I know in the New York local market, the channel that showed WWWF wrestling was WWOR TV Channel 9. This was a My Network TV affiliate, but it seems that Vince Sr. had individual deals with independent local stations, in all of his major markets. In some markets, different stations would air the two shows, and the B Show, that is All Star, would be stuck on, I don't know, like a Spanish language television station, for example, or Christian channels, things like that. The airing times would vary according to the TV station. In some cases, All Star would air on Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. and Championship Wrestling would be on at noon on the same day, or 1 p.m. sometimes in the 5 p.m. slot. For a period in the late 70s, Championship Wrestling, because Senior had acquired it from the IWA promotion, who they'd lost the slot to for a while, was stuck at midnight on Saturdays in the New York area. However, by the early 80s, Championship Wrestling settled into an 11 a.m. Saturday slot, and All-Star would typically air on Sunday at noon. And this would remain the basic schedule for the syndicated A and B shows until at least 1993. Although some markets would air the two shows back to back in a block on Saturday morning. So one show at 10 a.m., the other show at 11, or one at 11, the other one at 12, depending on where you were. If you're watching this and you have memories of this, I'd be really interested to know what TV station did you get it on in your local market, and what, if you can remember, what times were Championship Wrestling and All-Star on? I'm always fascinated by those sorts of details because nobody ever talks about them. In addition to the two syndicated shows, Vince Sr. had also secured a deal to show monthly shows from Madison Square Garden, the biggest house show in the territory and the mecca of all of pro wrestling, on the MSG Network, which was a cable and satellite channel serving the Northeast region in general. So basically perfect for the WWF. This would be hosted by Vince Jr., like all the other shows. He would do the interviews as well, if there were any. And Howard Finkel was the ring announcer at MSG. MSG has got a very distinctive feel and look, that kind of darker, it's almost like pitch black there, distinctive house mic. Incidentally, in 1987, they celebrated 10 years of Finkel as the MSG ring announcer on air, which was kind of a nice moment for him there in 1987. Anyway, from 1979, Vince Sr. also secured a deal to show their biggest monthly house show at the Philadelphia Spectrum on the Prism Network. This was also on cable, local cable station. This would be hosted by Dick Graham, initially alongside the local disc jockey Cal Rudman. Now, it's not really clear to me what the deal was with these two. It seems they were employed by the Prism channel rather than being WWF employees. Since they were outsiders to the wrestling business, some of the Spectrum shows can be especially funny to watch, especially the early ones, because Graham and Rudman were not smartened up to many aspects of the business, and they were almost kind of fans. They didn't really know what was going on. And Rudman especially is just like a mark. He's so excited about what's happening. Doesn't quite understand that some of them are heels and some of them are baby faces and so on. So you see, like, Rudman, I don't know, tonally, he's a very strange character. Now, Dick Graham would remain on every single Spectrum Prism broadcast until 1989, when it seemed that Vince Jr. decided not to renew the deal. Rudman pretty quickly has taken off commentary for obvious reasons, and they usually retained him as an interviewer. So all the way up until 1989, you can see Rudman interviewing various stars. And to be honest, they're some of the most funny interviews you'll ever see, because Rudman is just, he's just so weird and hilarious. And yes. Okay, anyway, this was the basic setup. So you've got Championship Wrestling, you've got All-Star, you've got MSG, you've got Philly Spectrum shows. And that is the basic setup that Vince McMahon Jr. inherited when he bought the company in 1982. And in the meantime, the WWWF had become simply the WWF. I'm not exactly sure when that change happened, but I do know it is something that Vince Jr. wanted, okay? It seems that while Vince Sr. was still alive, Vince largely kept things unchanged in 1982 and 1983. If you watch those shows, he's very much just keeping things ticking along, the regular loop, Bob Backlund on top, you know, it's the same old product, basically. He doesn't really change too many things. Rather, backstage, he was getting things ready for the big push, trying to get his kind of ducks in a row before the massive national expansion that was about to happen. Although he did make some moves in 1983, as we'll cover a little bit later on. Now, I should mention that from 1982, when Vince bought the WWF from his father, he had agreed to give jobs for life to the other business partners. One of them was Arlen Scarlon, for example. But the most important one from our point of view was a certain Gorilla Monsoon. Now, Vince was very clearly a busy man at this time. Not only he wasn't just a commentator anymore, he had to run the entire company, all the marketing, all the budgets, everything. He was the boss now. So from about 1982 onwards, it seems like Vince no longer had time to do the monthly MSG shows and the Spectrum broadcasts. And very quickly, he gave Monsoon this job in his place. So Monsoon was pretty much the voice of Madison Square Gardens and Spectrum broadcasts pretty much for the rest of the decade. And as we'll see later, Gorilla was the king of the house show broadcasts. He would be on pretty much all the cards from Boston Gardens, Maple Leaf Gardens. Sometimes you'd get the Meadowlands, Cap Center. I mean, Gorilla was basically on, I would say, 90% of those broadcasts. Although there are some exceptions, as we'll see when I really start to break things down later on. Now, Vince Sr. died in May of 1984. And here you can see a visibly and uncharacteristically emotional Vince accepting a Lifetime Achievement kind of Hall of Fame award at Madison Square Garden on behalf of his father. However, Vince had a vision to take over the entire world of pro wrestling and completely to transform what he had bought. These changes started almost immediately in 1984. After Hulk Hogan became world champion, Vince changed the opening credits, the opening titles of both Championship Wrestling and All-Star. And if you have a look at those title credits, he's putting Hogan front and center so that everybody would know that he was the new champion. Now, I cannot play the themes of either of these shows due to copyright. But Vince, who was much more in tune with modern culture than his old man, had replaced the old jazz tunes that they use, kind of old, they had like kind of cheesy old jazz tunes that they used, and Vince, in their place, put modern rock songs. Championship Wrestling started with Thriller by Michael Jackson. All-Star got Modern Love by David Bowie. I mean, I have no idea what the average crossover between a David Bowie fan and a wrestling fan was in 1984, but, you know, one of those things. Vince didn't want the focus of his TV output just to be on wrestling. He wanted to provide an entire entertainment package, a genuine television show, a kind of internal universe. And he aggressively expanded by buying up TV slots in major wrestling markets around the country, including KPLR-TV in St. Louis. I'll talk more about that in a moment. And KHJ-TV in Los Angeles. It seems at some point Vince plugged into the Fox affiliate network as Championship Wrestling switched from WWOR-TV Channel 9 to WNYW Channel 5 in New York. And WWF appeared in completely dead wrestling towns like Detroit on affiliate Fox networks, Fox affiliates such as WJBK, as well as changing the title credits. Vince also changed the look and the feel of the shows. He made them look a lot brighter, more colourful. He prominently displayed the WWF logo. And he ensured that he always had a colour analyst as a commentary partner. There's no more kind of solo Vince on commentary anymore. It's always at least a two-man booth. Initially, this was Pat Patterson. But from January of 1984... Vince acquired two key pieces of his broadcast team in Mean Gene Okerlund and Lord Alfred Hayes, who would both be absolute stalwarts for the company, and they stayed there for about a decade. Okerlund left in 93. Hayes, I think, goes all the way to 95, but I would double check that. He's at least still around in 1994. Okerlund initially replaced Pat Patterson as the colour announcer alongside Vince. Patterson, who was never a great commentator due to his strong accent, obviously had an off-screen role as part of the booking team and kind of Vince's creative partner, really, for many, many years. Okerlund himself was not the best on commentary. I mean, he's an absolute legend of the business, but his forte was not being a colour analyst or a play-by-play guy. It's just not his strength. He was much better utilized as an interviewer and a host. And it was not long before Vince kind of realized this. And I think possibly in his mind, separated out the role of announcer and interviewer. He had always done both himself. But I think that Okerlund clearly was so good at the interview role that from this point on, he started to see them as two separate jobs, okay? Anyway, he settled any lingering disputes he had with Bruno Sammartino. I believe there was some sort of court settlement or maybe even out-of-court settlement with Bruno. There was some pay dispute that he had from his second run as champion, I seem to recall. And he brought Bruno back in his old job as the colour analyst. You know, Sammartino, he was so well loved in the Northeast. Important to have that continuity there with the old company. In many ways, Vince made a clean break in 1984. But in surprising respects, there's quite a lot of nods to the Vince Senior territory and the kind of history of the company. Which is, I mean, I think it's quite nice to see, you know, Fred Blassie was still around, Albano was still around. It was still obviously the same company, although he was rapidly modernizing it. And I think for a lot of fans, a lot of the older fans, seeing Bruno there was a nice kind of continuity. As long as he was there, it's still the same old wrestling they enjoyed. Obviously, Vince was after new eyeballs, a new audience. He wanted to bring in families, he wanted to bring in women and all of this sort of thing. But Bruno had his role. Bruno actually stayed in this role until 1988, much longer than one imagines, and I think this is often forgotten. With Vince being so busy as he was, he also wanted to give up his role on All-Star in 1984, and initially they tried Gene Okerlund in the role early in the year. If you pick up an All-Star from, I don't know, let's say April 84, probably Okerlund is there. But He was pretty busy, as we'll see, and he, again, as we said, he's not best suited to play-by-play. So Vince brought in Jack Reynolds, who had some wrestling experience, I want to say, with that old IWA promotion that was around in the mid-70s. I think Jack Reynolds was their commentator. And anyway, somehow he got the job, and he was brought in alongside the Canadian football legend and former pro wrestler King Kong Angelo Mosca as the commentary team. Now, Reynolds, he was serviceable. He was just about okay. A little bland, bit of a charisma vacuum, if you ask me. But he was professional. You know, he could kind of do a job. Mosca, I have to say, absolutely sucked. I mean, he was just terrible. Thick accent, worse than Patson's accent, way worse than Bruno. I don't know what anybody was thinking, bringing in Mosca on commentary. But don't worry, this team didn't last long, but we'll get to that soon. Actually, it's just occurred to me that maybe Mosca was brought in because they were trying to break the Canadian market at this time. And there were certain kind of weird rules around Canadian television, which we'll get on to soon. So maybe that was part of the thinking. So another big change that Vince made is that he took the championship wrestling tapings out of Allentown, which sadly meant no more Joe McHugh. And he moved them to the much nicer Mid-Hudson Civic Center in Poughkeepsie, New York. All-Star tapings, meanwhile, moved to London, Ontario, later Brantford, Ontario, a completely impractical move which annoyed a lot of the wrestlers. If you ever listen to guys on shoot interviews around this time, they all complain about the TV tapings in Brantford or in London. They just, you know, it was such a long journey. It took a long time to get up there. And it was, you know, it's Canada. So, yeah, that was not popular with the boys. But it was brought about because there was a Canadian law at that time which dictated that all shows, or maybe it was all sports shows, on Canadian TV needed some aspect filmed in Canada itself. Now, I'm not I don't really know how Canada kept up that law, because it seems ridiculous to me, and I'm not sure how long it persisted, because by September 1986, the Ontario tapings had stopped entirely. Now, I believe there was a localized Canadian version of WWF programming that went out, which had at least one match from the Maple Leaf Garden show spliced in to ensure that they complied with this rule. But a Canadian fan from the era would have to confirm. The Canadian TV output has always been a bit of a mystery to me, I have to be honest. Although I will say, I mean, speaking of guys who absolutely sucked, Billy Red Lions is part of those, a lot of those broadcasts, and he is just atrocious. Whether he's the interviewer or on commentary, he's just bad. But anyway, Vince seemed to like the idea of an event centre. This is another big change that he made. He loved that room with lots of screens showing footage, you know, and the cameras and the technology behind. And this became a permanent feature of WWF television right through the 80s and into the 90s. Championship Wrestling and All-Star would now be interspersed with breaking news updates presented either by Gene Okerlund or by Lord Alfred Hayes to keep you up to date with all the latest developments and ongoings in the WWF. Sometimes they were called like special reports, and sometimes, you know, update from the event center, breaking news, you know, they loved it. Another key innovation was the addition of the in-show talk segment. I mean, there have been talk segments before, but I think it was really perfected in this moment. Now, this was initially a segment that was supposed to co-promote Vince's new tie-in, Victory Magazine, hosted by Roger DeBoard. It was called Victory Corner. But then they decided that Victory Magazine was going to be called simply WWF Magazine. And one of the columns in that was going to be called Piper's Pit. So Victory Corner was very quickly replaced by Piper's Pit, a vehicle, kind of superstar vehicle, for one of Vince's biggest new superstar acquisitions and the company's top heel, Rowdy Roddy Piper. Piper's pit would be the launching pad of many new storylines. Kind of really carried the angle and storyline part of the TV output for a long time. And it also carried a lot of the super hot Cyndi Lauper versus Lou Albano angle that led into the big MTV special, The Brawl to End It All, which can be viewed as a kind of precursor to WrestleMania. And while we're on this topic, Cyndi Lauper's role in making wrestling cool, getting it over with a new generation of fans, a different demographic of fans, is typically quite underrated. I know I've heard people who were kids back then. I was only 2 years old in 1984, friends. I've kind of caught up on this after the fact. But people who were in school around that time who were wrestling fans tell tales like they were embarrassed to tell their friends that they watched wrestling until suddenly, after the Cyndi Lauper angle, the people who made fun of them for watching wrestling were all over them for watching wrestling, and suddenly they were interested in wrestling, and suddenly they wanted to talk about it, and suddenly they were into it. So, you know, that's quite a major achievement of Vince and also of Cyndi Lauper and Albano for getting this angle over. Albano did all sorts of guest spots. There's a fantastic clip of Albano on the Letterman show that you should watch if you haven't seen any of that stuff. But this was the angle of 1984. Even though Hogan was the champ, the Brawl to End It All and the Cyndi Lauper stuff was just, it was mainstream, Anyway, in addition to transforming and expanding the syndicated television, Vince also made an aggressive expansion into the world of cable television. He acquired a deal with the USA Network. This was, in fact, his first move in August 1983. Remember, I said he was starting to make moves in 83, even though the big push comes in Jan 84. He's getting his ducks in a row. Now, this deal with the USA Network was initially just for 1 hour to show All American Wrestling, WWF All American, which was, at first, hosted by Vince himself. Now, All American would generally be a clip show showcasing particular stars or just, you know, the general goings-on of the WWF. It was significant because the penetration of cable would carry the WWF into more homes, and therefore it would get new eyeballs on the product. The sorts of fans who watched on cable may be different from the ones who'd watch on syndicated television, and perhaps a little more affluent. You know, cable TV cost a bit of money back in those days, so he was reaching a kind of new type of fan. Together with the audience he was hitting with the Cyndi Lauper stuff, you can see, you know, what he was going for. He was trying to get wrestling to be mainstream and not just a kind of sports niche thing, you know. After Oakland was hired, in fairly short order, he took over hosting duties of All American, and he would remain so until he left the company in 1993. All American was always Oakland's show. You know, unofficially, this was Mean Gene's show, All American, okay? Now, there are four things worth mentioning about All American. First, as it was a kind of one-stop shop, a fan who caught All American could more or less follow everything important going on in the promotion in just 1 hour. This is a pretty important function. And also, even if you watched Superstars and Challenge, All American could kind of reinforce, well, these are the really important things. You know, this angle, this interview, this star, this is the stuff to really pay attention to, okay? So All American was very well put together because it was for cable and it needed to be a kind of a hit for Vince, okay? Second, remarkably for the period, and at least in the 83 to 84 period, All American is notable because it would showcase some matches from outside promotions. Vince would acquire permission to show footage, say, from Mid-South Wrestling, And the other promoter, in this case Bill Watts from Mid-South, would oblige because it was more exposure for him. Watts didn't have a cable, you know, a prime cable slot like this, so he could showcase his talent on Vince's show. Now, what Vince was actually doing was showing off his new acquisition. That is, a wrestler who was about to come in to the WWF. He wanted to get fans familiar with that star before they came in. I think one example that he shows from Mid-South is Butch Reed, for example. Before Butch Reed debuts, you get a bunch of Butch Reed matches from Mid-South. This didn't last long, however, and from about mid-84 onwards, Vince would almost never acknowledge the world of wrestling outside the WWF again. There's a kind of weird period in 84 where Vince is much more open to acknowledging history, to talking about other promotions, to acknowledging the kind of outside world of wrestling. But from about mid-84 until, well, pretty much the end of the Monday Night Wars, the WWF became a hermetically sealed universe, with Vince never acknowledging the existence of anyone else, even to the point where when legend would come in, Vince would be loath to acknowledge their history. You know, like Harley Race became the king, even though he was an 8-time NWA champion. Vince had to kind of debut him as the king. Or when the Funk brothers came in, he changed Dory Funk Jr.'s name to Hoss Funk, didn't really acknowledge that both of them were former world champions and things like that. So yeah, it was just the way he wanted to run things. It's a bit like kind of the worlds of Marvel and DC or something, you know. Like, only in super duper a crossover event would you ever get the DC characters acknowledging the Marvel characters existed, and it was like that with the divide between the WWF. Now, the third key point I want to make about All American is that it would not only show clips from Championship Wrestling and All Star, but also it would show matches from some of their house shows, whether it was MSG matches, Philly Spectrum matches, or also matches from St. Louis, which they'd recently expanded into. More on that in a moment. For this reason, it can be seen as a kind of prototype for what primetime wrestling would become a couple of years later. Finally, I should mention that the theme tune for All American was absolutely awesome. I just love it. I'm going to see if I can get away with copyright and just play the theme tune for All American, because it's just fucking banging. Now, Vince wanted more than just this 1 hour on cable, and the USA Network seemed reluctant to give it to him at this time. But Vince, if you know him, he's a determined son of a gun. He never gives up until he gets his way. And he persuaded the network, USA Network that is, to give him a new 2 hour slot for a non-wrestling show. He was like, well, if you don't want wrestling, how about non-wrestling? I can fill the TV time for you instead. And it was styled after The Tonight Show, with McMahon as himself, as Johnny Carson, and Lord Alfred Hayes as Ed McMahon, complete with a big band. Kind of bizarre, but, you know, it was kind of like, okay, you don't want wrestling, I'll give you a talk show. And this show, of course, was called Tuesday Night Titans. And if you've never seen it, it is absolutely bonkers. Now, while it won't please the wrestling purists, since there's very limited in-ring action, for my money, this show produced some of the most memorable TV, wrestling TV of all time. In fact, some of the most memorable TV period, if you ask me, wrestling or not. the number of absolutely crazy things that happened on TNT is definitely worth exploring if you haven't seen it. There are far too many for me to list here. I probably won't get away with playing clips anyway, but the show is just incredible. The number of insane things that happened on TNT is probably worth a show in and of itself. But yeah, I mean, I would just look up like highlights of TNT or something and see how many great moments you can catch. Anyway, McMahon wasn't happy with just that. He wanted to take over the entire world of pro wrestling, as we know. And the biggest rival show to his own was Championship Wrestling from Georgia, or Georgia Championship Wrestling, which had a show on Ted Turner's TBS cable superstation. Now, Vince, and that was pretty much the 605 there, the mothership, as Dusty Rhodes called it, was the, you know, it was arguably biggest wrestling show on, certainly on cable at that time. And Vince successfully negotiated to buy the slot and, in one of the most infamous events in pro wrestling history, took over the slot, replete with the old set. They didn't change the set or the credits or anything. Sans their star commentator, Gordon Solie. Vince could not secure the services of Solie, and he kind of underestimated how important that was, because for many fans, especially old-time fans, Gordon Solie was pro wrestling, and the show absolutely tanked. Fans in the South did not like the WWF product. They thought it was cartoony, they thought it was slow, wasn't used to the wrestling. You know, it wasn't like the fast-paced action that they were used to. Furthermore, Ted Turner himself, who was a massive wrestling fan, was upset since Vince were showing footage from arenas around the country rather than taping matches in the WTBS studios. And I'll just say in passing that if people are really interested in this, I could do another show like this where I look at the NWA TV output and the WCW, like the Jim Crockett promotion sides of things, and I could go through their A shows and B shows and so on, as I'm doing here, but that is a quite separate show. Anyway, even though Vince made some half-hearted attempts to comply with Turner's request, he decided to cut his losses and he sold the TV slot back to, well, he sold it to Jim Crockett Promotions, who were trying to expand themselves at the time, for $1 million, which famously would help him fund WrestleMania in the following year. Vince had been sent packing from the South and wouldn't succeed in finally scoring a victory there until he finally bought WCW in 2001, after Ted Turner, who was really the person who was able to keep wrestling on air for all that time, and mainly it was his love of wrestling. He was basically a benefactor to the NWA and later to WCW. But he lost his power and influence following the AOL Time Warner merger. And, well, you know all the rest of that. You know all of that stuff. Every Tom, Dick and Harry talks about the Monday Night Wars. I'm telling you stuff, hopefully, that some of you don't know. Perhaps less well remembered is that prior to this, Vince had aggressively expanded into the crown jewel of the NWA's markets, St. Louis. And he had taken over the incredibly prestigious Wrestling at the Chase TV slot on KPLR-TV Channel 11, which had been in place in that market since the 1950s. Now, Sam Muchnick, who was the most well-respected of the NWA promoters and the kind of unofficial head, really, of all of the NWA promoters, everybody looked up to Muchnick, had retired. And Larry Matisick, the commentator, who loved St. Louis wrestling and he was a great, you know, great guy, he had some sort of stake in the office and he helped, or he had some sort of in with the TV company. And when Vince came calling with big money, Matisick helped to broker the deal because he wanted to keep wrestling on air in St. Louis. And of course, Muchnick had retired, so, you know, where was he going to get the talent from? So Wrestling at the Chase was filmed initially at the historic Chase Park Hotel. And you can go back and you can see Wrestling at the Chase Park Hotel right back in the 1950s. Really kind of different and cool, prestigious, event. You know, only holds like 1,000 people or something. They're sitting around having dinner and stuff. It's kind of really interesting. And then later, the big venue in St. Louis, they're kind of the MSG of that area, if you want, is the Kiel Auditorium. And if MSG was the big box office mecca of pro wrestling, then Kiel was kind of like the Oscars or something. You know, it was a prestige town. You're holding the Missouri State belt, which was Muchnick's belt, was seen as a stepping stone to the NWA title. And just wrestling in St. Louis in itself was seen as a kind of honor within the industry. Now it belonged to Vince. This is the crucial thing. Now Vince was running the Kiel, and everybody who knew anything about wrestling would understand that. That's really what he was after here. Now this, also this Wrestling at the Chase broadcast from January 84, it was filmed in December 83, it was Gene Okerlund's debut for the WWF, and you can tell he was pretty busy in 1984. I mean, how many shows is Gene Okerlund doing? It's kind of crazy. In addition to all the interviews and everything else, he's kind of everywhere around this time. And unsurprisingly, the old NWA fans, used to the Sam Muchnick style of wrestling, absolutely hated the brash New Yorker coming in with his cartoonish product. I mean, Vince's vision of wrestling was the polar opposite of Sam Muchnick. You know, Sam Muchnick's wrestling is like Dory Funk Jr. versus Jack Briscoe, you know, college credentials, legit amateur athlete, you know, NAACP champion. He loved stuff like that. That was the school he was from. Mat wrestling, chain wrestling. This was, not a lot of high flying or action, much more kind of mat based. That was the kind of Muchnick style, hour-long broadways, wrestling as chess almost. And here was Vince coming in with this kind of clown show. I can imagine the audiences who were raised on Muchnick wrestling, how they would have taken to that. And of course, the WWF's experiences in St. Louis as a town were similar to the TBS experiment. And after a couple of shows, they actually had to bring back Larry Matisick, who, unlike Gordon Solie, had agreed to work with Vince behind the scenes, and because he'd helped broker the deal. And as you can see here, he's trying his hardest to put over the WWF product for the local fans, but they were having none of it. They were like, "Larry, mate, you know, this is a clown show. This isn't wrestling." So by September, Vince basically gave up and cancelled all of the subsequent St. Louis tapings. I think September 84 is the last St. Louis show that they'd actually tape. And, they carried on trying to break the Kiel. They carried on up until about 91, I think, trying to promote at the Kiel. But even with Hulk Hogan versus Terry Funk on top in 1986, lightning hot Hulk Hogan, Terry Funk, an absolute legend, former NWA champion, they couldn't sell the venue out. That show, I think, was like 5,000 or something. Even Hogan versus Harley Race, a stone cold St. Louis legend, could not break 5,500 in 1987. You've got to remember, the Kiel was a 12,000-seater stage kind of arena. And when Muchnick was promoting those shows, like all through the 70s, for example, most months in St. Louis would have the gate would be over 10,000. So to say the WWF struggled in St. Louis is an understatement. And Vince finally gave up on the Kiel in 1988. So there we go. He was much, much more successful at resurrecting what had been dead towns, such as LA. You know, the LA promotion was under Mike LaBelle. I think he shut up shop in 81, 82. So it was kind of just dead, waiting for somebody to come in. The LA Sports Arena was a monthly show for the WWF. They used Hogan to break into that market in the local promotions there. And, you know, those shows did well. Detroit, which had been dead since the days of the original Sheik in the late 70s there, Vince successfully broke, and they ran the Joe Louis Arena that became a WWF mainstay venue for years. So Detroit was a hot town for Vince. But in any case, the purpose of Vince invading St. Louis and taking their TV slot, which is what we're focusing on, was simply to announce that he owned wrestling now. This was a symbolic victory over the NWA. This was a kind of a message to everybody who paid any attention to pro wrestling at all. You know, I am the man now. I own Muchnick's town. And that, I think, was more important than how well the WWF were drawing in St. Louis since Muchnick had retired. And because there was nobody left, because Muchnick was gone and there was no other promoter there, nobody sent Vince packing from St. Louis like they did down south in Georgia, where, of course, you had the nearby Crockett Promotions in the Mid-Atlantic region to, you know, essentially come in and kick Vince out, which is what happened. Anyway, in 1985, with the first WrestleMania on the horizon, a lot of big changes were afoot. For a start, Jesse Ventura, one of the best colour commentators of all time, semi-retired from wrestling with an ongoing injury that he'd had, and became an announcer, replacing the god-awful Angelo Mosca alongside Jack Reynolds on All-Star. Now, Ventura's debut on All-Star was on January the 7th, 1985. That means when he did WrestleMania 1 in March of that year, he had only been commentating for 3 months. 3 months. And it was only his sixth actual time commentating, because they did three taped shows at a time. And he'd done five All-Star tapings at the time of WrestleMania. Now, considering how great he is on that first WrestleMania show, Ventura must have been a stone-cold natural in this role. For my money, Ventura is the absolute best colour commentator in wrestling history, bar none. To me, he defines this role. He is absolutely perfect at this job. And, I mean, look, he hits the ground running in 85. Now, good ratings had finally persuaded USA Network to give Vince a new wrestling show, Primetime Wrestling. This debuted in January, hosted by the same team as All-Star, Jack Reynolds and Jesse Ventura. Primetime would be presented from a studio, with Reynolds and Ventura introducing longer matches from the house show broadcasts, interspersed with some analysis and clips of major angles from the syndicated shows. Now, Jack Reynolds didn't bring a lot of charisma to the presentation, and so by July of 1985, Gorilla Monsoon replaced him in both roles. So both All-Star and Primetime were presented by Monsoon and Ventura by the summer of 1985. Therefore, at this time, the WWF had three shows on USA Network: Primetime with Gorilla and Jesse, TNT with Vince and Lord Alfred Hayes, and All American, of course, with Mean Gene Okerlund. And then on syndicated TV, they had still Championship Wrestling and All-Star. Another acquisition in 1985 was a slot on NESN, the New England Sports Network, which would show cards from the Boston Garden every month, like the WWF's deals with the MSG Network and Prism, showing the Spectrum cards. This was a boon from a footage point of view, because the footage from these house shows was then cut up and used as the material for Primetime and All American, mainly for Primetime at this time. This made the WWF seem more big time, since the footage coming from different packed big arenas with different commentary teams from, you know, these different big shows, showed fans that this company was a major deal. It was a big company, you know. They also showed matches from the occasional broadcast on MSG Network from, for example, the Cap Center in Landover and also the Meadowlands in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Maple Leaf Garden shows provided material for primetime. In fact, I believe those Maple Leaf Garden shows were filmed almost entirely so they could clip matches for the Canadian TV to fulfill that strange legal requirement I was talking about earlier on. You'll usually be able to tell if a match is from Maple Leaf Gardens because of the prominent ramp in the middle of the ring. You can see that ramp there. This was the Toronto home venue of the Tunneys, by the way. You may remember President Jack Tunney was actually just the brother of the longtime Toronto promoter Frank Tunney. You get to know the arenas. If you watch enough of this stuff, MSG, for example, is really dark and it has that special mic and Howard Finkel's there. The Spectrum, it's got those big monitors you can see at the top. Can you see that big kind of central thing there? That's the Spectrum. Boston Gardens has those wooden steps on the side of the ring rather than the usual steel ones. And I might as well mention here, since I don't know where else we're going to talk about this, that Vince secured a similar deal to show the LA Sports Arena on the Z channel or the Z channel in 1988 and 1989. This seems to have been quite a short run thing, but there are complete LA Sports Arena shows because they were shown on that Z channel at that time as well. So at one time, the WWF had dedicated feeds for house shows at MSG, Philly Spectrum, Boston Garden, Maple Leaf Garden, and the LA Sports Arena, with occasional special broadcasts from other venues, such as the Cap Center in Landover, Maryland, that is. The Joe Louis Arena in Detroit had one or two shows from there. The Houston Coliseum, in Texas, which, for my money, has probably the worst announced team of all time in Bruce Pritchard, Mike McGurk and Pete Doherty. I mean, they are the absolute drizzling shit. One more huge development in 1985 was Vince, off the back of the success of the MTV specials with Cyndi Lauper and, of course, the first WrestleMania, was that he was able to secure a deal with NBC. That's network television, with one of the three major networks of that time, to show 8 special shows a year, which would start in May 1985, just after the first WrestleMania, fronted by Vince himself and Jesse the Body Ventura. And these Saturday night's main events shows drew absolutely enormous ratings, the highest in wrestling history. Saturday night's main event, which aired in a nighttime slot on Saturday nights on NBC, was filmed at big arenas around the country, not the usual house shows like MSG and the Spectrum and so on, but kind of unique places that you didn't usually see WWF from. It regularly drew over a 10.0 in the Nielsen ratings. That's over 15 million viewers per episode. This led to a number of even bigger one-off shows, starting with the main event in 1988, and that show was just called, there was the main event 2 and the main event 3 as well. This main event from 1988 had the extraordinary rematch between Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, and this was when the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, paid off the evil twin ref, after which Andre, of course, sold him the world title, one of the best angles of all time, and that drew a 15.2 rating and 33 million viewers. Arguably, that main event is what, you know, if WrestleMania 3 and that main event are probably like the twin peaks, I would say, of this golden age. I mean, that is the absolute peak of eyeballs on the product. That was when they were just on an absolutely hot streak during that time, okay? The significance of Vince getting WWF onto NBC at that time cannot be underestimated. It created millions of new wrestling fans. It's also significant for introducing the amazing commentary team of Vince and Jesse Ventura. Although a lot of fans will remember Monsoon and Ventura from the WrestleMania shows, maybe they had the tapes as a kid or they've seen the pay-per-views or whatever. And I think that Monsoon did the pay-per-views because Vince was just so busy, you know, didn't have time to be on commentary as well, especially the first few WrestleMania shows. A lot of fans will remember that team, the Monsoon Ventura one. And, you know, when you're looking at sites and so on, you often see Monsoon and Ventura listed. But for my money, Ventura worked best and had much better chemistry with McMahon himself. I mean, Ventura was pretty much the only guy who could get away with sparring with and even low-key bullying Vince. And the subtle kind of alpha rivalry between Vince and Jesse makes it possibly the best double act of this period. I say possibly, since the WWF was so loaded with talent at this time that there is one other kind of duo that we'll get to shortly who certainly give Vince and Jesse a run for their money. The success of the Saturday night's main event shows also, I think, made Vince think about his own regular TV in a different way, which we'll get to shortly. I mean, you've got to remember, they're working with the big NBC crews. He's getting to have a look at what like proper television is about now, and he's getting new ideas all the time. Now, before we get to the next set of major changes in September of 1986, there is one other massive broadcast development in April of that year. And this is where we get to the second of the kind of major duos, TV kind of comedy acts that Vince had at his disposal at this time. So in April, March, April sort of time, Jesse Ventura had to take a sabbatical to film parts of his movie, The Predator, which later came out in 1987, of course, and Ventura has a prominent, if small, role in that movie. And a certain Bobby the Brain Heenan, up until that point he'd been a manager, would deputise for Jesse on both Primetime and All-Star. Here you can see Heenan's debut on Primetime. And this was highly significant because Heenan and Monsoon would have amazing chemistry together as a kind of double act, with Monsoon, the long-suffering straight man, to Heenan's hilarious antics. And thus was born one of the great cornerstones of WWF programming during its golden era. Now, the next big raft of changes from Vince came, as I said, in September 1986, when he completely revamped all the syndicated TV shows and cut Tuesday Night Titans from the cable output. That show had kind of served its purpose, and as it had wound down, Vince, as he very often does, kind of stepped aside, and Gene Okerlund was, you know, palmed off the responsibility for hosting that show. And in fact, I've listened to a few shoot interviews with Okerlund, and he always says that Vince would always do that. He'd start a show and then he'd palm it off to him, you know. He did the same with All America, and he's done the same a number of times now. So the cable output was back down to Primetime and All American, and it would remain that. You know, Primetime was 2 hours, All American was an hour, that's 3 hours on cable TV. Saturday's main event, though, you know, the big NBC show, I think made Vince think differently about his regular syndicated A and B shows, and I think that's really why we get this big change at this time. Although he'd moved Championship Wrestling from Allentown into the Mid-Hudson Civic Center, the show was lacking the kind of epic feel that the SNME shows had coming from the major arenas around the country. Saturday night's main event felt like a big deal because it was coming from the Sun Dome in Tampa, the Coliseum in Richfield, Ohio, the Seattle Center in Washington and so on. I think Vince wanted to bring some of that pizzazz to his regular show. And so his two main syndicated shows would now be filmed on the road. The basic structure would be the same, taping 3 weeks TV at once, A show on Tuesdays, B show on Wednesdays. That didn't change. But now, instead of being at the same place every single time, they'd move around. And if you have a look at the venues for the A show tapings, which I noted down here, it's many of the same places that hosted the Saturday night's main event. Providence Civic Center, Sundome in Tampa, Meadowlands, and Arizona Veterans Memorial Coliseum. I mean, these are all decently sized 8,000, 10,000 seater capacity arenas, and they would make the shows seem more special. Vince changed the name of Championship Wrestling to Superstars of Wrestling and promoted Jesse Ventura up to the A show following his great performances on both Saturday night's main event and on WrestleMania. And to be honest, he's good on the All-Star shows as well. So Ventura, you know, now is in the big leagues. He's on the A show. Sammartino was still there too, so it became a three-man booth. But the chemistry between Vince and Jesse was off the charts. And Ventura, with his big booming voice and his kind of natural authority, former Navy SEAL as he was, this guy became the governor of Minnesota. He's making movies. Like, Jesse was a big deal. He just made everything feel special. And him being on Superstars, I think, made it feel major league. This is the big time. You know, he just made things feel like a big deal. All-Star became WWF Challenge and also initially switched to a three-man booth featuring Gorilla Monsoon, Ernie Ladd, for reasons that are completely unclear to me because I don't know how many fans remembered Ernie Ladd. I think he was last at MSG in the late 70s, I want to say. And Johnny V, who, of course, had become a manager. Now, this only lasted for three shows, which is to say just one taping. And then Challenge kind of reversed back or went back to just being Monsoon and Heenan again. I am not sure why Heenan was missing for the debut show or why Ladd came in for that show. But typically, Johnny V would fill in whenever Heenan had to manage, and he'd replicate this if Heenan was ever on colour for the house shows, as we'll see later on. But there it was. Vince had now truly launched his vision. Superstars, the A show with himself, Sammartino, Ventura, Challenge, the B show with Monsoon and Heenan, plus Primetime with Monsoon and Heenan carrying the cable output, backed up by the very handy catch-up show All-American with Mean Gene Okerlund. He also, at this time, added a new show to the syndication output, essentially a mirror of All-American in terms of its function as a clip and catch-up show, a recap show. And this show was called WWF Spotlight. It was presented initially, just like All-American, by Okerlund and Lord Alfred Hayes, who was unofficially sort of like Okerlund's sidekick on a lot of these shows. I mean, Hayes was on a lot of the All-American shows as well, if you watch them. However, after a couple of months, Okerlund, such an incredibly busy man, he had so much on, didn't have time to do Spotlight, and was replaced by Craig DeGeorge, who was later himself replaced by Sean Mooney, who would probably be the most dominant host of WWF Spotlight from 1988 till 1993 when he left. There was a strange running gag on Spotlight whereby Mooney would call himself Ian Mooney. His evil twin brother, his kind of strange twin brother Ian Mooney, and was joined by numerous co-hosts, including at one point Howard Finkel, for example, you didn't often see in the studio. And the Ian Mooney gag is notable for being completely exclusive to spotlight. It's never referenced anywhere else in WWF programming at all. And among true wrestling nerds, Spotlight is one of the harder shows to collect, by the way, because many episodes seem to be missing and have never seen the light of day. Some of the spotlights you'll see are just kind of taped from VHS. WWE has never kind of re-released these digitally. They never re-aired them on the 24/7 channel. They've never shown up on the network. They're not on Peacock now. So anyway, the ones that you can watch, especially from the Mooney era, I would say are quite a lot of fun. Spotlight is a fun show. Anyway, the basic setup: Superstars, Challenge, and Spotlight on syndicated TV, primetime and All-American on USA Network, Saturday Night's Main Event every 3 months or so on NBC, plus the broadcast from the house shows on those local cable networks I mentioned earlier, lasted from September 1986 until pretty much the end of our golden age here in 1983. And there were a few key changes in this six-year time frame. So for the rest of this video, I'm going to touch on some of those in order before getting into some, let's just say, super obsessive detail to right at the end of this special presentation that I'm giving here. So if you're in for the real kind of fine detail, stick with me. Okay, so starting with Superstars, San Martino finally left the WWF in July of 1988, so Superstars became just Vince and Jesse. Now, with the greatest of respects to Bruno, who's an absolute legend, they were not losing a lot at that time. Bruno had long been a little out of step with everything going on in the company. He was philosophically at odds with Vince. You know, he didn't share the same vision of wrestling. And if you watch a lot of those shows, he didn't say a lot in any case. Bruno would go like 10 minutes without saying anything. Ventura would stay until August of 1990 when he left following various disputes with Vince and would be replaced by Rowdy Roddy Piper. And I have to say, the broadcasts from around this time are truly mental, almost cocaine-fueled in their general energy. Both Vince and Hot Rod seem like they are out of their goddamn minds here. And if this wasn't mental enough, at some point in 1991, Macho Man Randy Savage is added to the booth too. Now, there is such a thing as too much energy, friends, and I personally find the Vince-Piper-Savage combo a little bit too much to handle. I mean, it's just, it's a headful to listen to those three. Savage came and went from commentary until he left the company in 1993. He kind of did this thing where he'd wrestle a few months, he'd go back on commentary a few months. Savage was kind of in a weird place around this sort of time. And I think he actually left the company because he wanted to wrestle more and he didn't want to be a color commentator, so I've read in the past. Piper sticks around for quite a long time. But from about January 8, 92, is replaced with Mr. Perfect, who was injured at this time and acting as Ric Flair's manager. Piper, who was feuding with Flair, later had an IC title run and had a few matches with Bret Hart, as I recall. Now, Mr. Perfect, I think, was perfectly good as color commentator, to be honest. He wasn't bad in this role by any means. By January 93, Savage is back. Perfect has gone back in the ring. You know, he has his feud with Ric Flair. And I seem to remember Lex Luger, Mr. Perfect feud around that sort of time. And this is where Jerry Lawler debuts on colour. And, of course, Raw is right around the corner. So you can see where Lawler, being the colour commentator, comes about. It's right here, okay? Anyway, over on Challenge, they tried to give a place to Tony Schiavone in 1989. So we pretty much got Monsoon and Heenan for most of the time. But Schiavone comes in here in 89. I think it's with a view to replacing Monsoon long term. Monsoon had suffered a mild heart attack in January 88. Unfortunately, though, Tony didn't stay in the company. He went back to WCW, and Monsoon pretty much stayed on all the way until Jim Ross came to the company in 1993. So there's Jim. So Lawler's come in on Superstars in January 93. At the same time, Jim Ross has come in on Challenge in January 93 or thereabouts, okay? Monsoon and Heenan were basically inseparable, and Challenge, which featured a lot of sleepy jobber matches, nothing matches, was pretty much a perfect showcase for them to ad-lib and talk crap and shoot the shit for an hour. There are times when you're watching Challenge where you forget a match is even happening because you're listening to, you know, the various comedy routines and the banter on the commentary, you know. If you ask me, that's where Monsoon and Heenan were at their best most of the time. For the major storylines, I think you want Vince and Jesse. But when it's a nothing match, for pure entertainment, you want Monsoon and Heenan. So they've got different strengths. You know, they've for big time, for superstars, Vince and Jesse, or for Saturday night's main event, Vince and Jesse were perfect. For sleepy Sunday challenge show, Monsoon and Heenan were just, you know, brilliant. Now, Monsoon was apparently quite unwell by 1993, which is one of the reasons why Jim Ross was brought in. More on this soon, because I think Vince was looking to replace Monsoon, and that Monsoon was looking to wind down for quite a bit before that. But yeah, Jim Ross, and you can see, I mean, if you're a fan of Raw, if you're a fan of later wrestling, the Jim Ross, Jerry Lawler team is just kind of waiting to happen. It doesn't happen for a while, but it's waiting to establish itself here at this time. Now, on prime time, it was basically the Gorilla and Heenan show for many, many years, until in February 91, some bright spark decided to make it a studio show with a live audience, with Vince himself replacing Monsoon. And this version of the show was very weird and frequently features some truly hideous early 90s fashions from Vince and various other people as well. You know, big baggy 90s jumpers. As was so often the case, after the initial launch, Vince stepped aside and palmed the show off to a Sean Mooney. Now, if you ask me, all these changes to primetime were probably for the worse. They also changed the matches they showed. Rather than primetime showcasing MSG, Philly Spectrum, Boston Gardens, and so on, they now simply tacked a few extra matches onto Superstars and Challenge tapings, and Mooney and Lord Alfred Hayes dubbed in the commentary afterwards. Primetime felt somewhat rinky-dink in 1991, smaller, oddly kind of low budget, and Mooney and Hayes recorded voiceovers for all the prime times from the debut of the new format starting in February the 18th, 1991. Now, you can see January 91 primetime shows still have all the different commentators from the different arenas. The situation with the different commentary teams on primetime, I don't know if that was something that bothered Vince. If it did bother him, it took him 6 years to be bothered by it. I found one episode of Primetime from May the 11th, 87, which has an absurd number of commentators on it. I mean, I counted Gorilla Monsoon, Bobby Heenan, Vince McMahon, Jesse, Sammartino, Dick Graham, Ken Resnick, Lord Alfred Hayes, and Ron Bass. There's 9 commentators on one show on different matches. I watched through it all, and to be honest, because they go back to the studio in between the matches, I actually think it makes you feel like there's a lot going on in the world of pro wrestling, and that the WWF is just like, there's so much going on. You know, there's a life of it outside this one TV show. And, you know, Gorilla and Bobby are just kind of, you know, giving you the highlights of hot, exciting action that's happening everywhere, you know. I kind of liked it. The 91 prime times with Mooney and Hayes on commentary, I think, feel a lot smaller. And this, I think, is the first really bad change that Vince made to the TV. And I think he realised it himself, because this new format, prime time, didn't last long and was replaced by another new format, the panel, which debuted in November 1991 and would remain the format until prime time was replaced with Raw in January 1993. Now, the panel shows are kind of fun You know, you get a bit of the old Gorilla Bobby magic plus a rotating roster of guests. They generally tend to end up with everybody shouting, I find. But they're, you know, I think they're a curiosity, the panel shows, as are that the 91 version of Primetime's weird as well, the studio version. Anyway, before I finish, I want to share some exclusive data that I have collated. Now, if you're a wrestling fan, screen grab this, because this is original content, my friend. I put this spreadsheet together myself. Here are all of the commentary teams on the WWF house show broadcasts from January 1984 until they stopped broadcasting in March of 1992. Now, remember, all these broadcast duties were beyond the regular TV. So if you take Gorilla Monsoon, let's say in June of 1987, he had at least four big house shows to call, plus all of Challenge, the studio bits for Primetime, plus whatever else he needed to do, for example, on Coliseum home video releases, because often they have studio bits presenting clips and things like that. If you notice, Vince carefully restricted his own kind of on-screen duties just to doing superstars. He was obviously busy running the company and booking and all the rest of it. He only did that one MSG show in January of 88 due to the aforementioned heart attack that Gorilla Monsoon suffered from. I have a theory that from at least 1986 onwards, it seems like Vince was looking for somebody to replace Monsoon long term. If you recall, Jack Reynolds was brought in September 1984 to take over from Vince presenting All-Star. And to me, the fact that he hired Reynolds and didn't just ask Monsoon to do it from the get-go shows that for whatever reason, he wanted somebody else. Maybe Monsoon didn't want to do it. Maybe Monsoon wanted a quiet life. He was going to get paid no matter what, right? So Reynolds was not only the host of All-Star, but was the first host of Primetime with Jesse Ventura in January 85. However, it didn't last, and Monsoon had him replaced in both positions by July of 85. So, you know, you have Monsoon on All-Star and on Primetime in place of Reynolds, as well as maintaining the commentary for all of the house shows. So maybe by 86, Vince and Monsoon had reconciled their, you know, they were happy with Monsoon doing Challenge and Primetime, but maybe Monsoon was like, okay, boss, but I'm still doing all these house shows. I'd really love not to do all of this as well. I have heard, from shoot interviews with Jim Ross and various other people, that Monsoon himself was looking to restrict himself to doing just kind of, if he could just do the Primetime with Heenan, and maybe the Challenge shows, he'd have been happy with just that. So it seems like Vince was using these house show broadcasts to try to bed people in, basically to replace Monsoon, and actually train them on the job with Monsoon showing them the ropes before he'd hand over. Many of them didn't work out long term. Ken Resnick, Craig DeGeorge. They put Resnick on with Graham there, Craig DeGeorge with Graham, Roger Kent, Rod Trongard, Schiavone. None of them really stuck until Jim Ross came in 1993, and he really was then, you know, Monsoon basically retires not long after that. If you look at all of the chopping and changing, it's clear that the MSG Network shows, the Prism shows, the NESN broadcasts, the Boston Garden Cards, was something of a pain in the ass for the crew, I think, for whatever reason. And knowing Vince's attention to detail, I really do wonder if it bugged him to have all of these different commentary teams and these odd commentary teams who didn't quite get little details right featured on Primetime. And maybe this was ultimately the reason why in 1991 they had Mooney and Hayes dub over all the Primetime matches, because, you know, Vince is just a stickler for that sort of stuff. And it's like, well, you know, I'm not sure if I want Ron Trongar flubbing his lines on Primetime and stuff like that, you know. Now, Lord Alfred Hayes really was another great workhorse of these televised house shows. I mean, if you look at it, Mooney and Hayes are basically the default house show team. But for some reason, I also get the impression that Vince was constantly looking to replace him too. And it looks like that whenever he can, he does. And, you know, somebody doesn't work out and they have to turn back to Lord Alfred. But I get the impression that even though Mooney and Hayes end up doing basically like 60% of all the shows, something like that, I get the impression that they were always trying new people on these house shows because they were ultimately looking to move on from Lord Alfred and move on from Monsoon as well. They were getting old and tired, you know. I should note that while you're looking at this, a lot of the three-man teams involving Heenan were not actually three-man teams, but guys subbing for Heenan when he goes off to manage. And this was, as I mentioned before, Johnny V's main job for about a year or so there. He was like a sub for Heenan for one or two matches per card, stuff like that. Now, the house show team really was the C show team, if you ask me. Because it strikes me that Vince tried to keep a full crew of about 9 on-air talents at any given time. 3 play-by-play announcers, 3 colour analysts, and 3 interviewers. Again, in an internet first, I am the only person in history to bother to make this table. As you can see, generally speaking, the A-team was Vince on play-by-play, Jesse on colour, and Gene Okerlund on the interviews. The B-team was Monsoon on play-by-play, Heenan on colour, and somebody else in the Gene Okerlund role. I would call it Sean Mooney for the longest time. And the C-team was a bunch of announcers they tried out, generally with Lord Alfred Hayes doing everything else. The versatility of Lord Alfred Hayes seemed to cover a lot of what I have called the C-team, since he could do the event centre updates, he could do interviews, he could go on colour when needed, and he also filmed a lot of the Coliseum home video stuff. He was a much bigger part of the TV package than many might remember. You know, I think he's famous mostly these days for saying promotional consideration paid for by the following. But he was actually a much bigger part of the overall TV package, really from 84 until 94. Now, before I finish, let me unpack this table a little bit further, as I believe that in Vince's ideal vision, he had 2 jobs that he was looking to fill, not without much success, from at least 1986. There are 2 distinct lines, and it took him a long time to find the ideal person for these 2 jobs. Let me go through the 2 lines. First, we have the Ken Resnick line, which starts with Ken Resnick, who's hired in 1986. Then he is replaced by Craig DeGeorge in 1987, who himself in 1988 is replaced with Sean Mooney. And then, of course, he is replaced by Todd Pettengill after he leaves in 93. The second line is the Jack Reynolds line. And he is basically replaced by Roger Kent, who himself is replaced by Rod Trongard, who is replaced by Tony Schiavone. And it takes a while for them to replace Schiavone with Jim Ross. Now let's go through these again, because I think that these are 2 slightly different jobs, and to somebody who doesn't have a keen an eye as me, they may miss these sorts of details, and this is the sort of thing you're coming to this channel for. The Ken Resnick line was clearly intended to be able to cover all of the general duties of Gene Okerlund with any additional commentary they may do as a bonus. Recall that Okerlund did commentary in 84, sporadically filling in on occasion from 1985 to 87. He doesn't do any commentary after that. But his chief duties were hosting All-American, giving event center updates, conducting interviews, and of course doing Coliseum home video stuff. In shoots, both Ken Resnick and Craig DeGeorge have said that they were brought in chiefly to lighten Oakland's workload. By 1986, Oakland was presenting All-American, Spotlight, TNT, doing all his usual stuff, and he was getting burnt out. Now, in my mind, the only man to perfect this role was Sean Mooney. He was there from 1988 until 1993, and I think he had exactly what Vince seemed to want. He was kind of cheesy, he had that perfect sportscaster look, he was kind of young and good-looking, he was clean-cut, he could do subtle comedy bits, he could play the straight man next to Heenan, or next to a Lord Al, somebody like that. And I tend to think that Mooney is super underrated at what he did. He's obviously, you know, he's not Gene Okerlund. Nobody was Gene Okerlund. But as a number two to Okerlund, I think Mooney was pretty good. By 1991, Mooney, who stuck around much longer than Resnick or DeGeorge, had built up enough experience to start covering properly on play-by-play. Although I will say that Mooney, you know, as good as he was in the interview role, he absolutely sucked as a commentator. But, you know, that's just my opinion. The Reynolds line was clearly intended as a long-term monsoon replacement, as we've talked about, if only just to do the house shows, right? But I think ideally they wanted this person on Challenge as well. Remember, Jack Reynolds was hired to do All-Star, and he was hired to do Primetime. And, you know, since we know Monsoon ideally just wanted to restrict himself to doing the studio bits with Heenan and would have happily dropped his house show stuff and possibly also Challenge as well, I think that you know, Roger Kent, Rod Trongard, Shivani, they're all searches for a replacement for Monsoon. And it's not because, I don't know why, but Kent and Trongard kind of just didn't work for whatever reason. It's just obvious they didn't, their faces didn't fit in. It's really when Shivani comes in that you can see that they're trying out Tony on Challenge. They, you know, maybe Monsoon is going to sit with him for a while. And one suspects that the plan was to phase Monsoon out and just to have Tony and Bobby Heenan there eventually. However, that didn't happen, of course, because Shivani left. And the eventual replacement would end up being Jim Ross in 1993. I mean, it took a long time. Anyway, that's probably more about the WWF broadcast teams than you ever wanted to know. If you were a fan at this time, please let me know your memories in the comments. If you have any questions, I'll do my best to answer them. If not, hit like and subscribe, join the channel, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, and I'll see you next time. The Academic Agent, what the world is watching.